All right. All right, so here we are, step four and five. And, you know, it came to me this morning when I was doing some prayer and meditation that, you know, we're all just fellow travelers on this journey, you know. So this weekend we're kind of taking you through a journey of our life, as crazy as that may be. So, hold on a second. So, you know, I talked a little bit about it last night. So when he got into recovery, I kind of stayed on the outskirts of it for quite a while. You know, I would go to open meetings, absolutely loved it. Occasionally I would take, you know, Terry would have a sponsee and be like, oh, his wife really needs to go to Al-Anon. So I would take him to a meeting, still on the outskirts. You know, doing one, two, and three you can do without having a sponsor and working a program, because you know you're just screwed when you come in. You're just so powerless. And then finding that higher power and turning your life over to it. You know, you can do those things without really working with the sponsor. And so, you know, a few years later, you know, I'm going to Al-Anon meetings sometimes, you know, just not coming all the way in and sitting down like we were talking about last night. And, you know, God's amazing. He puts these people in our lives, right? And I started meeting some amazing women that were in Al-Anon before it was even Al-Anon. And I got that able to exhale, you know, to let a little bit of it go. And, you know, and then I go to a meeting in Brighton, England, and I go to a Kohanon meeting, and I got just the fire. You know, it was the first time I found fire in recovery, and I wanted more. And so I started looking into it a little bit, still not ready to come in and sit down. You know, and then a couple years later, you know, it was time. And, you know, started working the steps. And then it came to the fourth step. So I'm really good at taking his inventory. I don't want to look at my inventory. And, you know, and then I start thinking about it. It's like, well, I have all these justifications. I wouldn't have done the things that I did if he hadn't have done the things that he did. And so I had to get past that justification of my behaviors. It wasn't my reaction was not normal to the things that happened in my life, because everything gets a little bit distorted or very distorted with living in addiction. And even in recovery, my reactions were warped and over the top for most things. And I had all those old, that anger and that resentment and fear that I had spent so much time just, you know, putting in a closet and shoving the door closed. And then, you know, the next thing I put in the, and I don't want to open that closet. I don't want to look at that stuff, because there's a lot of stuff in there. There's a lot of pain in there. There's a lot of resentment in there. And that fear of opening that closet door and letting it all out, what's that going to look like? You know, I've got a little bit of normalcy in our life. I've got a little bit of breathing room. And I don't want to look at that stuff. I don't want to open that door. So, you know, trusting somebody else to sit down with and talk to it about, because every time I tell people, you know, my past, you know, they always have these wonderful solutions, you know, that because they don't understand addiction and alcoholism. You know, so they come up with these things that are damaging to my spirit. I was thinking last night about, we had this one friend, and these were really good, dear friends of ours that, you know, of course, are party friends. I don't know how dear that is. But, you know, when we split up and I was talking to her about what was going on, she looked at me and she goes, well, I knew you guys were going to split up. And I said, oh, you know, how's that? And she goes, you didn't have lampshades. I looked at her and I went, okay. And so in moving, as many times as we moved, my husband packs or used to pack. He doesn't pack like that anymore. You know, everything goes in the truck. Everything goes in the truck. It doesn't, you don't wrap shit. You just pile stuff on top of it and it just keeps going. So collateral damage was our lampshades. And so we had lamps with no lampshades because, again, he's using all the money to go do what he does. And lampshades are pretty low on the priority list. Electricity and food are above those. And so we didn't have lampshades. And so that's an exaggerated version of everything, the suggestions people would give me when I opened up and I told them what was going on. So now I have to open up and tell my deepest, darkest secrets to somebody. Holy shit, you know? And I don't want to hear what somebody judging my life and my actions and my reactions. And so having that faith to open up and trust somebody to hear that is an amazing thing for me because I was so closed. I didn't want anybody to know. I didn't want people to see, you know, because it looks okay on the outside. I didn't want people to see the inside. So, you know, trusting, just trusting somebody to sit down and be honest with. But what I do know, and I found this amazing, she was my sponsor up until a couple years ago because she's got Alzheimer's. And I'll tell you what, a sponsor with Alzheimer's is great in the beginning, you know? Because in the beginning, the last couple years, every time I'd come to her, she'd be, oh, honey, that's okay. I love you. So it's great, you know? But I decided I needed a little more accountability than that at one point. God bless Bonnie. I love her. But, you know, I know that I can't heal the pain inside of me if I stay stuck with it. There's no healing in just covering it up and not looking at it and letting it go. And so finding someone to sit down and do that with. And I remember when I did my first inventory, I had it so locked, so deep that the only way I could express a resentment was it made me sad. That was the only feeling I could come up with. There was no, it was just sadness. And so I'm sitting with her and then I'm judging, oops, don't want to touch that. I'm judging my own opinion of myself and my inventory because I can't go deep enough with it. But what I do know is as you do it more and more and more, you get deeper and deeper and you uncover more and more things. And so, you know, that's why that the steps are so gentle. They're so gentle. And just trusting the process in it is amazing. And so good, I left you plenty of time, babe. So with that, I'm gonna pass to the crazy guy next to me.
Yeah, good morning. Thank you, Don. And I'm Terry, I'm an addict, alcoholic. So everything that happens in life matters. Everything I did, everything done to me is all in my experience. It's in my DNA, it's in my life, right? And I stuff it all down with drugs and alcohol, and I don't ever look at, I was raised in a household where you were taught that, you know, children are seen, not heard, don't ever express an opinion. I was told, you know, my father would say, you know, you're a handsome boy, except you're so ugly when you cry. And so it's like, I'm living in this Irish Catholic baby factory. And I have no idea what I'm feeling. You know, nobody, when my mom got sick, like I shared with cancer, at 11, nobody once said, are you okay? How are you doing? You know, how are you processing this? Not, you know, so we do the best we can. I did the best that I could, right? And that just wasn't all that great. So then I encounter what we're doing here this weekend. So I have an aunt who, on her 100th birthday, she's an old gypsy woman, and she was wise, man. And on her 100th birthday, she was born in 1899. So 1999, on her 100th birthday, I asked her a question that has stuck with me forever. I said, Aunt Barb, in your life experience, what is the greatest thing that you've ever seen? You know, what is the most, like the biggest, the most influential thing that you've seen? Knowing that in her life was the Great Depression, World Wars I and II, Korea, Vietnam, space travel, telephone, indoor plumbing, automobile, the internet, you name it, all of it, right? Radio communication, all of it in her lifetime. And she looked at me, and she would always think things through, and her eyes started to get really sad, and she looked at me, and she said these words. It was the television. When the TV came on, everyone went inside, and they never came back out. Now think about that, right? Look around your own life and your own experience. I'm around people that know who's on Dancing with the Stars, but nobody knows who lives next door. You know, we're in this world. So the world, America, used to be lived on its front porch. You know, growing up, I knew every kid on the block. Everybody knew every parent. We all knew each other, right? And that was part of it. But when the TV went on, in everybody went. I remember being when first color television. I remember going to a neighbor's house. I am old. I went to neighbor's house, and it showed Tinkerbell splash the screen with the first color. And everybody, oh, there's a quote I love. We all have free will. Our will never moves towards evil seen as evil. It moves towards an evil that we convince ourselves is good. I'm going to get a great big 75-inch TV so we can, you know, watch movies together as a family. But in reality, just me and sports, right? Everything that happens over the course of our lives. So I lived my life on the front porch until I started getting high. I shared last night, I used to love to run. And it was like, you know, me and my little brother would run the neighborhood. And we would jump over literally everything. We would yell, jumping partners to the end. And it was the most, you know, a summer's day, trees to climb. A place like this would set my soul on fire. And then when drugs and alcohol entered my life, so did the darkness. When drugs and alcohol, because drugs and alcohol are a graveyard for everything beautiful, for alcoholics and addicts, not for normal folks. Normal folks, like it says in the book, you know, it's fun, laughter, but not for me. So I'm consuming all these drugs and alcohol and all this wrong behavior, and I'm so twisted up inside, and then I encounter grace. Someone works a 12-step on me. I get to get sober in treatment. I write out an inventory. I share it with the chaplain, start making a little progress. We write the letter to our son, Brandon. We're making a little bit of progress. Things are getting better. I get out of treatment, and I started on a 90 and 90, right, because they said that increases your chance. And I did not know where the road to recovery led, but I sure as hell knew where the road I'd been traveling had been taking me. I could tell you the story of my alcoholism through Donna's blue eyes. When I first met her, these blue eyes sparkled like the sea. And then as I drank and I drugged, I watched that look change, you know, from tearful, you know, oh, where were you? I was worried. I called the police, the hospital when I did an all-nighter, to anger. And then the anger to rage, and then the rage to disgust, and then ultimately to indifference. It didn't matter anymore. I had killed all that stuff. So all this stuff's inside me. I get a sponsor, and he puts me to work on the steps. I get busy. I write my first inventory. The way I like to do inventory today is I have a man do the inventory, do the writing, and we do step 5 on the same day. And the reason I like that is because my past is broken and painful. And I don't think it's really healthy for a new person to wade into the broken past for a long period of time. So that's how he had me do it. I was grateful for it. And I sat there with this man and I do my step 5, right? And I go through everything and I read it all. And you know what? It was like this form of inventory he used where you write all your columns and do all that. But then he would have you write down future gifts you wanted, promises you wanted to make to God, strengths you saw in others, and all these other things. You know, I was good with all of the bad shit I did, but whenever it came to strengths I could see in myself, that made me cry. It's like, because I could see no strength in myself. So I get done with my inventory, and his name was Steve B. His name now is Freehawk. He was like this. He was like the magnet for newcomers. You know, long hair. His wife Julie played music up on the boulevard. You know, beads and patchouli oil, and he was just cool. And I'm sitting with him, and I do my step five, and I finish, and he looks at me, and goes, "Brother, is there anything else?" I said, "No, sir." He goes, "Are you sure there's nothing else?" And I said, "No, there's nothing else." He goes, "I'm not talking about something that you don't recall. I'm talking about something that's right here at the front of your mind right now. Our experience is if there is something, you won't stay sober." He said, "That's our experience." He said, "The very best you could hope for, if there's anything else, the very best you could hope for would be someday to come back and get an opportunity to get sober again and be sitting in front of another man with a chance to let go of whatever it is you're afraid to let go of now." And I started to cry. I looked at him, I said, "Yeah, there is." And when I was done sharing with him, he said, "I love you, brother. Thank you for trusting me with your pain." Now, I will tell you this, that is not what's kept me sober. I have encountered and done more amends. I have encountered more dark stuff between 15 and 33 than I did in the first 15 years. When Bill said more is revealed, I'm going to tell you what, it comes through sponsorship and through hearing inventories. I'm doing an inventory with one of my guys, and he tells me, I get there and he rides a bike up, right? And he'd been taking the bus. I go, "Oh, you got a bike?" He goes, yeah, I got a bike. I go, "Oh, that's cool, man. I'm glad you got yourself a bike. Where'd you get that?" He goes, "Oh, I bought it at the convenience market." I go, "I didn't know they sold bikes." And he said, "Well, I bought it in the parking lot for 20 bucks. And I said, "You mean you're riding a stolen bike?" And he goes, "Well, I didn't steal it." And I said, "Brother, that is not a bicycle. That's a crack pipe. That's what you're riding." And he goes, "What would you do?" I said, "I would suggest that you walk it up to the police station, tell them that you bought it at the convenience store, and see what happens. And then what'll happen is they'll tag the bike, and 30 days later, if nobody claims it, you'll get your bike back. And in the meantime, keep riding the bus to the job you now have. Keep calling the mom who's now talking to you again." And he looked at me and said, "I'm not willing to do that." I said, "Cool, but I want to say it was fuck you, but I work a program." So then I realized, in listening to that, I realized, oh man, I'm judging the shit out of him. And then I thought, I robbed the Huffy Bike Factory. So I started buying bicycles, right, and donating them and all this stuff. So through this process of inventory over the years, what's happening, I want to give you this is a perfect time of year to share this visual for you. Doing an inventory is like preparing a pumpkin for Halloween. We all got that experience, right? So you cut the top off it, and then you get in there and you start scraping it, right? Ugh. Remember the handfuls of the, and then you're getting more of that stuff. Then you get a spoon or something, you start to really scrape the insides of it out. That's what an inventory is. And then you cut whatever the face is, and then you put a little candle inside and you light it, right? Kind of like when we get that poison out that our spirit starts to light up. And so there I am with this beautiful light. But if I'm not continually involved in the work, what happens is my life will creep back in and I'll start to fill that pumpkin with shit. So here's what happens without regular inventory. That beautiful pumpkin that is giving off this light now gets filled with shit, and you can see it oozing out of the eyes and the mouth, because that's the process of life. And it isn't being out there being destructive. It's just we live in a world during difficult times. There's so much negativity. There's so much stuff that I can get consumed, and there's so much more that's revealed that God has opened up so much of my life to me. I've started to learn things about myself that I had suppressed forever. When I was in treatment, I blamed everyone, right? Somebody's responsible for everything, and it's never been me. And so I remember being in treatment, and they told me it was Father's Day. They said, I was complaining about my dad. They said, why don't you write your father a letter? And why don't you forgive him? And I thought, cool, that's all right, cool. I followed directions. So I wrote the letter. And I wrote that letter, man, and if you would have heard that letter, it was amazing, right? I wrote that letter. I bring it back to my small group, right? So it's me and all sorts of newcomers. And there's a point to what I'm saying. We have a great mix of people, from lots of sobriety to newer recovery. We even have one friend here who celebrated 1 year yesterday. I mean, it's an amazing thing that occurs in recovery. But I got to have people with more time and less time. That's the magic. That's how it all works, because we get to learn so much from each other. So I wrote this letter, and I explained how I was in treatment, breaking the chains of alcoholism that had bound our family since we came over on the boats from Ireland. And I talked about every failure of my father and how he didn't develop my athletic abilities, and that he didn't do this, and that he used the strap. And my dad would take that belt, and he would whip your ass if you deserved it. I deserved it. But so I had all this stuff, and when I read it to the small group, all the other newcomers, they cried with me. They were all so moved by this story. 2 years later, I found the letter, and I read it. And when I read it, I realized everything in that letter was bullshit. The only thing that was real was that he was my father. And it was not that I had lied. I had told the truth. I had told the truth as I saw it. But we don't see things as they are. We see things as we are. And so here I am, an angry, frightened little man trying to blame everybody else for my failure. And that's the view I had of my father. So by then, something had happened. My dad died in 1989. I got sober in 91 and wrote that letter. And then in 93, I read that letter and I realize, oh, man. Let me tell you about this father that I forgave. Now, you heard some of my story last night, right? Leaving Donna and our son after the baby died. Cheating on my wife. Going bankrupt, having her car repossessed, you name it, you know, burglaries and robbing shit. I got a lot. I wasn't a good dad. At Christmas time, my first year sober, my son says to me, we're getting things ready for Santa, a little sandwich, some cookies, some milk. We put the milk out and the carrot sticks for the reindeer. My son says, Daddy, what's that milk for? I said, it's for Santa. And he was 7 years old. And he looked at me and said, Daddy, Santa drinks rum and Coke. Because that's what I had already taught. I'd already taught my children what Santa liked to drink. So that's the father I am, right? Moving my family around. My dad, on the other hand, this man that I forgave, my mom got sick with cancer when I was 11. And my dad would get up every morning and help get 10 kids ready for school. Lunch is packed, shoes shined, off to school. Then he would he'd go to work on the lunch break, go see his wife at the hospital, come home to cook dinner for the kids, maybe do some grocery shopping, do some laundry, back to the hospital to see his wife, who he never cheated on. And that was my dad's life for years. But I had to forgive him. Same dad that when I was 18 years old, my parents were salt of the earth folks. They worked hard. They were involved in the PTAs and the community. And I remember getting arrested for 7 felony burglaries at 18 years of age. And my dad hired a lawyer who drank with the judge. And the legal fee was 1 case of Bombay gin. And for a case of Bombay gin, half went to the judge, half went to the lawyer, and my dad shows up in court with me. Now, he was a proud man. He worked his ass off his whole life to do what was right in the community. And my dad was also, like, handsome and smooth, and people really liked my mom and my dad. And my mom looked like Elizabeth Taylor. You know, my dad was just this gentle man. And my mother had actually made a list of all the different potential wives for him to consider, you know, when she died. And so we show up at the court, and this woman walks up, beautiful, just high class. She was one of the women on that list. And she walks up and she says, "Jim, how are you? I haven't seen you since Kate's funeral. What are you doing here? Did the little son of a bitches rob you too?" And with the saddest look I will never forget, my dad looked at her, and then he looked at me, and he said, "No, one of the little son of a bitches is my son." And he put his arm around me. He said, "Come on, son." We walked over to the other end of the courtroom and sat down. That was the man I forgave. So you better check your thinking. That's why we have sponsors, because I need a sponsor, because they don't have my emotions running through their head. They don't have my fears in their heart. And so I started learning to do this work. I started to learn how to do a fear inventory, how to put down what I was afraid of. But with 20 years of sobriety, I did this fear inventory. I went to a Kohanon workshop that Don and another woman had done on fear in Florida. And you would fill in blanks, you know, "I'm afraid of what?" And then you write what the lists are. And then when you're done, you take words out of each sentence and they form one new sentence. And here's what my fear inventory said. My core fear was that I didn't believe that there was a God, even though I'm a man of deep faith. How could that be, right? And so when I read my sentence, I couldn't believe it. But here's what my sentence said. My core fear is that there is no God, and I have this fear because I don't think that God will do what it is that I want done, even though I don't know what it is I want. Think of this line in the book. We put unreasonable demands upon God, ourselves, and others. Is that an unreasonable demand? Right? So I'm forgiving this father. Right? I forgive this man who lived a life so righteously. Today I can tell you I'm proud as hell to be the son of James Richard Murphy Sr. My dad's father abandoned him when he was 2. Right? He never had that influence, but he learned and did the best he could. And guess what? I think everybody's doing the best they can too. And Bill Wilson said these words, "Imagine that, us judging someone else." So my dad didn't select one of the wonderful women. My dad liked to drink. He had vodka in a 2-gallon pump, and literally you just pump. That was good, man. I saw that bottle. I don't know, a strange attraction to that bottle. My dad picked a different woman, a woman who had pump vodka. And my father's final resting place. When he died, I got there a few minutes after he died. She wouldn't let us have a service for him. And she said, "I'm going to fulfill your father's last wishes, and I know you kids won't." And I said, "Well, what are my dad's last wishes?" And she said, "He wanted to be cremated, and he wanted his ashes spread in the casinos of Las Vegas." So you got to check this out. When I'm going through, here I am walking through the casinos in Vegas, and there's an ashtray. In the name of the Father, Son, Holy Spirit, amen. If you saw me and my family walking through a casino, they'd think these people are insane. They pray to the ashtrays. I've done a lot of inventory work, and I've taken a lot of men through the work. I've also had a horrible experience in inventory, and I'm going to share that with you. That sponsor who I trusted so much, who's such a beautiful soul, he also was, there are a lot of outside influences that we have traditions that are supposed to keep them out. Like there's trends and there's vibes, and what is hip today will be gone tomorrow, and that's just the way life works, always has. But back then there was a book called Iron John, and it was directed to men. Beat drum, bum, 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 bum. Beat the drum. Give your shame to the fire. You know, gather up men and give your shame to the fire and beat the drum and all this stuff, right? So he was really into this stuff. So he took a bunch of us sponsees up to the forest. And so we're up there, we have a big bonfire, and he says, start to scream your pain and your shame into the fire. And then people are going, ah, into the fire. So I go, holy. So, you know, I start joining in with him, and I'm giving my shame to the fire. And you know, some of them putting on little, you know, woo, it's just whatever, man. So we're sitting around. The next morning, we're sitting in a circle, and he says, because we're getting free, what we're all going to do is we're going to share something out of our inventory, something personal. Now, I don't really know the other men in the circle. I know and trust him, though. He's my sponsor. He's the man who's helping me, who I trust and I hold in high esteem. And so I sat there and I thought, okay, what do I do, right? What am I going to give off my inventory? And I gave one up, and here's what I gave up. Now, this is kind of a funny story, but it isn't funny when it's yours, when it's in your wound, right? Because when we bring it into the light, God gets to sanitize it, right? But when I was like 11 or 12 years old, there was a dog across the street. I'm babysitting it, and my dick's starting to get hard, and I don't know what to do with it. But so I thought I'm going to try to stick my dick right there, right? Now, that is a horrible, I can't believe I'm saying this shit in front of all of you or her, right? So I tell that story, right, that I had tried to do that and how much pain it had given me and how by doing an inventory, it didn't have the same sting. It didn't hurt as much in my soul as I did it. And so, good. You gave this... shame to the fire, and then another person, they go through the deal. And then about a week later, I'm at work, and they go, Terry Murphy, line one. I pick up line one, and I grab it, and somebody's going, roof, 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 roof. Fuck. I was a newcomer, man. You know what my first thought was? Kill yourself. It was so devastating. I don't blame my sponsor. I don't blame the guy who did it because it's kind of funny in retrospect, right? And I know how to use humor to deflect pain. But the reality is I learned a really important lesson there, and that is an inventory is clearly between God, myself, and another human being, not a group of strangers. And so some may find freedom in releasing their stuff in front of others. I just have always found my peace in that incredibly sacred relationship that exists between a sponsor and a sponsee. And when I'm hearing a step five, my phone goes away. There are no distractions. I'm here now. I mean, I've seen and heard of every imaginable horror of a sponsor taking the call in the middle of the guy's inventory. Please be present to the sacred moment because it's been through hearing other people's inventory. I've heard what I need to change. I've heard about, you know, how men have been broken in their spirits and found redemption in recovery, and it's so important. So step five, right? Step five is a vitally important thing, and if you are ever blessed with the opportunity to hear one, understand you are going into a sacred experience. And it should be treated as such. So this is a true story that's going to blow your mind. Pope John Paul II, who was already a saint, which in the Catholic religion, it's usually a few hundred years after you're dead that you become a saint. He was sainted almost right after his because of his works. And this story will let you know why he deserved it. So what happens is if you're a priest, and my sponsor's a priest, so I know all the priest stories of recovery, right? And I know lots of crackhead priests too. Some of them who are out smoking now, trading the chalice for a $20 rock. You know, it doesn't matter who you are or what you believe. This disease is merciless. Thank God these steps are merciful. And so this priest gets the opportunity to go see the Pope in the Vatican. And he's really excited about this opportunity, right? Because it's cool, you know, to meet you. You're like, that's it. That's the guy. And so he gets there and he decides to go to a different church. And all over Rome, there are these beautiful churches. It's an epic experience to see some of them. And he goes walking up the stairs of this church to go pray and meditate before a few hours before his meeting with the Pope to be ready for that visit. And as he walks up, he recognizes the guy sitting on the steps begging for money. And he kind of thinks, do I know him? And as he's in there praying, the guy's face keeps coming to him and he sees it more clearly and more clearly. And then he goes, I know him. And he walks down the stairs to the beggar and he looks at him and he says, Father Gregory? And he looked up at him and he said, A long time ago. And he said, can I help you? Anything I could do? He goes, there's no help for me. I'm an alcoholic. This is my life. So the priest goes to the Vatican. And the way it works when you go to see the Pope is they'll have a line of kneelers, right? And the Pope will come in, say hello, then he'll go to each one, hand him a rosary. And each one gets to whisper a special prayer to the Pope. And so when it was this man's turn, he asked the Pope to pray for his brother priest, the alcoholic. And he asked him to pray for him. So when the deal's over with, nothing to it, father's leaving, and one of his cardinals calls him over and he says, hands him a slip of paper, right? A little envelope. He opens the envelope and it says, Pope John Paul requests your presence at dinner tonight, along with the alcoholic priest. So he said, holy smoke, I'm going to have dinner with the Pope. So he goes back across to the other church and he finds the beggar priest. And he tells him, you and I have been invited to have dinner with the Pope tonight. And he goes, I can't go. I'm filthy. I'm this. He goes, come on, I'll help you get cleaned up. And he did. And the broken priest went with the other to see the Pope that night. And they're expecting to walk in a room full like this and a giant table of food. And he gets there, and there were only four seats at a table. The Pope, his cardinal, the priest, and Father Gregory the alcoholic. And the four of them dined and visited and talked. And when it was done, the Pope turned to the cardinal and the healthy priest and said, can you excuse me, please? Will you excuse us for a moment? And he left the Pope with the drunk. And the two of them sat there. The others left. About 20 minutes, they come back in. And the Pope says, thank you, brothers, for being here. And Father Gregory, thank you for accepting your assignment. What he did was, they said, what happened? And they said, the Pope said, I needed to say my confession. And so I asked the broken priest to hear my confession. So Pope John Paul, the holiest man in the world, asked the alcoholic priest to hear his fifth step. And then when it was done, he said, would you do me a favor? Can I reinstate you as a priest? And will you then minister to the drunks that sit on the steps of the churches throughout Rome. And that's what the man did till the day that he died. So the sacredness of hearing someone's inventory, it was the only way that this wise man could enter into the other person's brokenness, through hearing his pain, through sharing his pain. So it's a sacred experience that we get to have together when we get to share these inventories. So I take men out into the, I started trail running, distance running. I've ran since I turned 50. A little boy liked to run. How well do you think that works with drugs and alcohol? Not too good, right? So I get sober as I'm approaching my 50th birthday. Somebody said, Terry, what are you going to do for your 50th? You know, a lot of times men want a new car, something fancy, get a new woman. I love my smoking hot wife. I say, you know, I think what I'm going to do is run a marathon. And they said, you're going to run a marathon? That's 26.2 miles. You're going to run a marathon? Have you ever ran before? And I said, yeah, once upon a dream. A little boy who used to like to chase the clouds. And they said, why not a half marathon? I go, you don't know my story. I never did a half of anything. So I started doing the work, right? In sobriety, Tarek said it last night so beautifully about that we have an advantage, and we do. Clean and sober people, man, it's amazing. There's an old saying that God invented whiskey to keep the Irish from ruling the world. And so so I start doing the train, and I'm doing the run, and I'm getting stronger, and I can do almost anything because anything's possible in recovery. So I go out to the mountain. I started running because of hearing the fifth step. I had this young dude who I sponsored, and I knew he was twisted up, right? And it took a lot to get him to do his inventory. So I did not want to. I knew he'd never do an hour of power. I knew that there was no shot for that. So I took him up on the mountain. I heard his inventory, and I said, I'll meet you at my car in an hour. And so he sat for an hour, and I ran my first run as an adult that set me up and set in motion all of the races that I've ran, which is 10 marathons, 14 half marathons, and 4 ultra marathons. And the last race I ran was a few years ago. It was 100K in the desert mountains. And and Donna was standing at my side and gave me a kiss as I ran into the early morning rain and mud. And 17 hours and 7 minutes later, I crossed the finish line. And my mind was filled with one thought. The miracle is not that I finished. It's that I had the courage to begin. Because I have a disease called alcoholism, and it centers in my mind. And it tells me, you ain't nothing but nothing. I know how you did. I know what you tried to do. I know your sin. I know your shame. I know your pain. It knows all of that. And that used to be the only voice I could hear in my spirit until the voice of Alcoholics Anonymous to the men and women in recovery who shared their stories. And through their stories, I got a new voice. And when that voice said, how dare you try to do this? You're over 60 years of age. How dare you? And I got another voice that says, thank you for sharing. Now shut the fuck up and let's go do this. Because that's what we do for each other in recovery. Because as I said, alcoholism is a place where dreams go to die, but this is where dreams take flight. This is where people go back to school. This is where literally modern day Lazarus has risen from the dead. And the only thing we got to do to stay alive is help somebody else. And a vital part of that is the taking of our own inventory and the sharing of our inventory and the being fully present to another as they bear their souls. You never know how much pain another human's in. In this room, we all got a lot of it. There's a story out of Buddhism that says, if every one of us in the room were to put our problems here on the table and share it, when it was done, we would all want our own problems back. And I believe that, man, because I know there are a lot of people here that are having a lot of heavy hearts. So I take people out to the desert a lot to do inventory. So I take this young man, Ryan, and he's a twisted up young man, right? And we go out there, and his inventory was probably 5 hours long. And I had the flu that day. But he was writing all day, and I felt horrible. But he called me up. I got it done, man. I could not wait. I said, cool, man. I'll meet you at South Mountain Park. And he meets me there, and we hike up into the desert, down into a ravine. And I sat there, and I listened to this young man tell his tale. Oh, my God, the pain that young man was in. And when we were done with the inventory, we start walking out. By now, it's dark. I'm thinking it's going to be our inventory. I'm feverish. I'm feeling rough, but I was present. And as I start to walk, I got all this gastrointestinal pain. And I think, man, I got a little air out here. And I'm walking in front of him, leading him out of the forest. And as I do that, I feel my ass is wet. And I go, oh, no, I just shit my pants. Right, so I changed my demeanor right away. I go, Brian, get in front of me, because I don't want him behind me. I don't want him to smell the shit. Turn right, turn left. We were going to go get dinner later too, right? And so I get him to the car. I got to go, man. And I start to drive away, and I think, shit, man, I told him we're going to go get dinner. He's 18 years old. He got no money for growth. I back the car up. I wad up a 20. I roll down his window. I throw the 20 in, and I go, I got to go. I call Donna. Donna, I shit my pants. And she goes, I'll get the shower ready downstairs. Oh, baby. She said, oh, baby. And so I get home. Oh, my God. I get in the shower. I clean up, and I'm sitting there, and I tell Donna what happens. And she looked at me. She said, poor Ryan. Imagine what he thinks. Like, his sponsors, his hero, his knight in shining armor, who is now, get to your left, turn right. Here's the money. You know, like you're a dirty, like you. So I called him up, and I said, Ryan. And he goes, yeah. I said, Ryan, I got to admit something. He goes, what? I go, when we were walking out of the desert, yeah, I shit my pants. And he said, oh, thank God. I thought it was my story. So you never know what you're going to experience, right? The sacredness of what we get to do. So there were these two guys in Phoenix named Nick and Eric, and I sponsor them both, right? And these guys were like Joe and Charlie, right? Bill and Bob. These two cats were relentless, man, starting, killing it, just doing everything you could ever imagine. And Nick had a blue mohawk, wore a Misfits jacket, and tatted up and pierced up and, you know, all this stuff. And Eric's insane, and he's... And these two guys, though, do more work to help others than you could just ever imagine, right? So Nick said, when he asked me, will you sponsor me? I said, I sure will, man, under one condition. He was working shoveling gravel for a landscape company. I said, yeah, there's one condition, Nick. And he said, what's that? I said, you have to go to school and take at least one class. He had a GED out of high school, just one class. I don't put conditions on sponsorship, but I told him, I said, bro, you know, if you don't do something more than shovel gravel and smoke cigarettes and vape all day and drink energy drinks and eat fast food and live in a halfway house, your life's going to suck after a while, and you're not going to stay here. And I love you, and I want you to do that. Will you do that? And he said, what he said to me was, yes. What he thought as he said yes was, fuck you, you old prick. That's what he said. Sorry to curse, but that's the story. And so he went to school and he found a love for it, right? Today his name is Dr. Nicholas B. He's a geneticist. This guy is unraveling the human genome, right? So he had to go, he left Phoenix to go to the University of Chicago, which had the premier genetics program in the nation. And so he left there. We had a going away party for him at my house. And when they left, everybody had sparklers. And we all did this stuff, right? And then we got the fire pit, right? One of those big metal fire pits, and everybody threw their sparklers into there. That was in like November or so. Months later, Eric's heart's breaking because this was his best friend. And it's time to do another inventory. So Eric writes his inventory. And he comes over to my house. And when I'm done with inventory with my men, what we do is we take the character defects and write a list. We take the amends and we write a list. And we take the shame and the pain and we light it on fire. Now, the reason I do that, now my sponsor, Howard P., and my current sponsor, Father John B., both said we save our inventories. We save them as a reference point. And I said, well, Howard, you're old, and John, you're a priest. I do not want if something happens to me, I do not want my children and my granddaughters reading about some of the things their grandfather or father did. I'm not ashamed of anything. But I've seen inventories laying around cause so much pain and suffering in other people's lives. So we get all the right information. So we got it all ready, and it's time to get rid of Eric's inventory. So we go over to my fire pit that hasn't been used since Nick's going away. And we light all the papers on fire, and we drop them in the fire pit. And we got our arms around each other. And I start talking about an inventory. I'm from Phoenix, Arizona. The mythological Phoenix bird is a beautiful thing. I'm sure you've seen pictures of it. But the story of the phoenix is that it rose from the ashes to a new life. And I think it's so symbolic of what we do in inventory. And so we take his inventory, we drop it down in the flames into the fire pit, and we're praying to the mythological phoenix bird for new life out of this inventory, and the fireworks start. Somehow there were, unbeknownst to me, there were 20 or 30 sparklers in the bottom of that baby that went off. And there we were in that moment, soaked in tears. Tears of knowing that God was present in our inventory. He's always present in our inventory. So because of what those things have done, they've opened up a path to healing and to freedom that never knew were possible. So do yourself a solid. If you haven't done inventory in a while, get to it. If you have an opportunity to hear your next one, try to make it a little bit more special for the person who did the work. You may have heard hundreds of them, but for them, it's their one. You know, together, we can do what alone is impossible, right? And that is to heal broken people. So we thank you for steps 4 and 5. We got a half hour break, and then we will really have some fun as we delve into character defects in 6 and 7. Oh, that's no, it's her specialty, I was thinking. So Tarek, anything else before?
Come back in 30 minutes.
See y'all in a half hour.